Yes, as they say, that hope had run out for some of the hostages. According to Baba, this young man who had been kidnapped earlier in his life by Boko Haram, when he spoke to the terrified inhabitants of the village, they spoke of the fact that Boko Haram had been there for 3 days, the first 3 days following the kidnapping, but that no one in the village was willing to do anything. They were too scared. The chilling account received from the villagers through unconfirmed sources, because not one person in the village would even talk directly to the media. They were too afraid. Represents the very worst fears of the families of those 223 girls that are still missing. They now know that they're being tortured, they're being raped, and that many are being killed. Four were dead. The villagers told them they were shot by their captors in front of all of the other girls. As an example to the other girls, they were shot before them. They were shot because they were stubborn and uncooperative, according to Boko Haram. Boko Haram brought those four girls in front of the 223 and said, this is what we're going to do to those girls who fight being raped, who are difficult and uncooperative during this kidnap. They blew their heads off. And then they took them to the outskirts of the village, and they threw a little dirt over their bodies, and the kidnappers moved on. Everyone we spoke to was full of fear, said Baba. They didn't want to come out of their homes. They didn't want to show us even where the graves were located. They just pointed up the road. The tiny rural village halfway between Chibok and Damboa, in the besieged state of Borno, in Nigeria's northeast, had been rendered helpless, to stop Boko Haram as the gang swept through on trucks loaded with squirrel girls that they had captured at gunpoint before torching their school. They scared them to death. You know, Machiavelli wrote The Prince to instruct Italian aristocrats as to how best to achieve the papacy and then to rule as popes. And the principal theme of The Prince, Machiavelli's book on how to be an effective pope, is that while it is desirable to be loved, being loved is difficult, and it is unreliable. And so what Machiavelli said was that it is far easier for a person to influence others, to control others, to manipulate others, to seize and wield power if they terrify others, if they are so vicious, so brutal, that they instill fear in the heart of all of those that they lord over. And so Machiavelli said, you know, and if you want to be powerful, if you want to wield the office of Pope of the Roman Catholic Church effectively, be vicious. Instill terror in the hearts of those that you control, and they will quiver in fear. They will be afraid to oppose you. Why the Roman Catholic Church was so instrumental in creating such horrific torture devices, which they deployed on the masses, keeping them in check. It is what Boko Haram has done to Nigerian civilians. It is what Islam as a whole has done to most of those in the world, including Muslims. Everyone we spoke to was full of fear. The tiny rural village did nothing. Now, venturing further up the track, Baba and his fellow vigilantes found the two girls. Baba, the youngest of the group, stayed back as his friends took charge. They used my knife, he said, to cut through the ropes. I heard the girls crying. And telling the others that they had been raped, then just left there to die. They had been there with the other girls from Chibok, all taken from the school in the middle of the night by armed Muslim men, all wearing soldiers' uniforms. This young man, Baba, said we couldn't do much for them. They didn't want to talk to any men. All we could do for them was to get them into a vehicle and drive them to the security police in Damboa. They didn't talk. They just held onto each other, their arms draped around each other, and they cried. Why isn't the world crying? Why aren't we huddled together in our disgust of Islam? For Baba, a peasant farmer son who has never been out of rural Borno, it was shocking to see the young girls defiled and brutalized by the notorious terrorist that he knew so well. But his own life has been full of tragedy, and he told how he had seen much worse than the horror of what he witnessed that day in the forest clearing. A bright-eyed Muslim boy from the Kanuri ethnic group, proud of a tribal facial scar that he had and therefore nicknamed Small Baba by those who knew him because of his short, slim frame. One night as he slept in his family's mud house in the village, the gunman came door to door looking for informers. He says, I heard some noise. I woke up and I saw men coming through the door, shooting at my uncle who was in bed beside me. That was the end of my childhood. It was the end of everything. I saw his body laying next to mine covered in blood. Tried to crawl away, and the men turned their guns on me. They grabbed me roughly and took me outside to a pickup truck. Baba, telling his story confidently and lucidly, wants to shake over the details of his two hellish years in Boko Haram, in the camps in the Sambisa forest. For this light boy, there was no such worldwide interest in his kidnapping. As he scurried back and forth at the command of a ruthless gang, as they dug into a woodland far from help, rescue, or even interest. He remembers many of them lived with women who had come voluntarily into the camp. I'm going to tell you, folks, Muslim women are their own worst enemy. They not only abuse their own daughters sexually, they not only form the manufacturing womb for future terrorists, they are as vicious as the men who rule over them. He never saw any girls abducted. The latest phenomenon is unknown to him. There were many abducted boys, he said, but no abducted girls. We were all scared to death and had to do whatever we were told, whether it was fetching water, fetching firewood, or cleaning their weapons. We couldn't make any friends, he said. We had no idea who we could trust. I was made to sleep next to the Boko Haram elders, one of the senior preachers. One of the senior preachers. One of the senior preachers. I had no special boss in the camp. I was ordered around by everybody. The men, they prayed five times a day. And yet, would leap on their motorbikes and trucks to carry out killing sprees. There should be no yet in that sentence. I knew they had started out as holy men, as religious men. But now I saw them as criminals, loaded with weapons and ammunition. Actually, there's no distinction between the two. That's why the Quran has the term jihadist. That's why there is the term mujahideen, making the religion synonymous with mass murder and terrorism. As he got older, he was taught how to use an AK-47, how to strip it down, how to clean it, how to reassemble it. He could never understand what drove the men. They were monsters. It's amazing. Young boy never made the connection. What drove these men? What made them monsters? He felt convinced that they were all mad. What drove them to insanity? Other than the one thing they shared in common, Islam. This is a quote. They were wild. Even when they prayed so loudly in groups together, making us join in, they were insane. They were unpredictable and always planning their next murderous attack. I never wanted to be one of them. Wow. They prayed as they planned their next attack. Then came the day that I was given a special, sickening task. One of the commanders told me that I was going to go on a journey and I would be tested for my loyalty to the group. He brought two of his senior men to stand beside me. He said I would be going with them to my family's home. And I would have to shoot and kill my own father. Bubba had no time to plan. He was sandwiched between the two fanatics as they set off on a motorbike for his village home. I pretended that I was willing to do the job. I took the ammunition belt I was handed and clung on as we drove through the rough bush. We'll return to the story when Shattering Myths continues after the break. Boko Haram wanted to test this young boy's loyalty to Islam. He was born a Muslim. So the Islamic clerics at the head of Boko Haram said, "We're going to test your loyalty, your devotion to the religion by taking you to murder your father." When we were less than a mile away, he said, nearby the village where I grew up, he says, I threw the ammunition belt to the ground, and I just pretended that it had slid out of my hands. They stopped to let me pick it up. Instead, I ran as fast as I could through the undergrowth. I didn't care about the thorns or the snakes or anything. They shot at me. I could hear the bullets flying past and hitting the trees. I was not going to stop for anything. I made it to the village, and some kind people let me hide there. The next day, Baba went home. He saw his grieving parents and siblings for the first time in 2 years since he had been kidnapped. He says, but I couldn't stay. I was bringing danger to their door, and we all knew it. Confirmation of that came when Baba stood, or soon heard, that Boko Haram chiefs had put a bounty on his head for his defiance in the equivalent of 12,000 pounds, but about 18,000 U.S. dollars, a fortune in the local economy. His family, terrified, abandoned their home soon thereafterwards, and they live today in a remote part of Borno, rarely seeing their eldest son. He lives with a cousin who is also under a Boko Haram death threat. He became a valuable volunteer with the vigilantes. He became a valuable person for anyone who wishes to know the truth. He helps man checkpoints where Baba points out members of Boko Haram to the rest of the vigilantes. He was soon exposed to brutality of a different kind, this time from the government side. He helped them to get one of his captors, a man he only knew as Alajai, arrested and handed over to the soldiers. It felt good at first, but then they shot him dead right there in front of me. Now joining patrols armed with a shotgun and a machete, Baba has been able to give valuable intelligence as to where the Nigerian authorities can look for Boko Haram's camps. By now, I've seen this violence many times. It never gets better, Baba said. It will always be an even worse sight than finding the schoolgirls in the forest. He says there are worse sights than that. Think of what this young boy has had to endure because of Islam. Think of what those 223 girls are enduring now. Come to realize that four of them were initially shot dead because they were uncooperative with their kidnappers and rapists. Consider the fact that two of them were tied to trees so that they could be gang raped. 223. Still out there. Having spent 3 days just 1 hour's drive from where they were taken. Which tells you, no one in the world, no one amongst those who are empowered in our despicable world, deprived of all moral fiber and morality, wants to rescue them. They don't want the truth known. Sad, isn't it? Isn't it amazing with a story this poignant, this insightful, this telling? There wasn't a single American media outlet that published it. That makes you want to shake your head and scream, why? It makes you, if you are moral, if you still have compassion, if you have character, hate Islam, wants to expose and condemn the religion for its disgusting manifestations. To tell the world that Muslims are rapists because Muhammad was a rapist. To tell the world that Muslims are terrorists because Muhammad was a terrorist. To tell the world that Muhammad was engaged in every manner of perversion and that we should condemn the religion that he invented. Back to Shattering This. Before we move on to the next story, which is an amazing story. It's about the election in Egypt. We have Glenn on the line, and I would love to hear Glenn's thoughts on the previous story. Hello, Glenn. Welcome.
Hello, Yada. Good morning. Yeah, I've been listening to you talk about these various travesties, and, you know, I hear everything from, you know, abject murderous wickedness to apathy to cowardice and, mm-hmm. you know, all this other
yes.
stuff.
Yes.
And I think about the Boko Haram kidnapping mm-hmm. thing.
Yes.
The recent rampage killings.
Yes.
And what comes to my mind is there is another source of death for mm-hmm. innocent people. It's been going on for quite some time in the world. And that is the death to innocent parties who are written off as mere collateral damage, the most, you know, dehumanized
yes.
term
yes.
from our drone killings.
Yes.
And I look at all this going on and I think about the rampage killings and I think, you know, what comes to my mind is America is sowing the wind.
Yes.
And, you know, we are inevitably going to reap the whirlwind and these rampage
yes.
killings are just a small token of payback.
Yes. Yeah, it's true. Sure. That collateral damage when you're you're engaged in, particularly in drone warfare. I mean, listen, in Afghanistan and Iraq, the collateral damage of our invasions is about 1 million people. About 1 million Afghanis and Iraqis lost their lives as a direct result of America's invasion. And so that was the collateral damage of us making two very bad situations much worse.
Right.
I was going to say, but the point that you make is actually more compelling. Yes, I know the numbers are larger than 1 million in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the collateral damage associated with the drones is actually more vivid. Because these are individuals, not a single one of them has ever engaged in attacking an American. These are individuals who are simply civilians practicing their religion. Now, while I hate their religion, and we should all hate their religion, the fact is that just because they are Muslims practicing their religion doesn't give me or anyone the rights to kill them, to murder them in cold blood. And that is what we're doing. And not only are our drones being used without any due process, without any criminal investigation, without any judicial hearing or trial, and based upon one man's decision, yeah, go kill them. But there's also, with our drones, when we go fly them over other nations, there's enormous collateral damage, somewhere between a third and two-thirds of those killed are not fundamentalist Muslims perpetrating jihad.
Right. Right. And what makes the killings like the Boko Haram thing or even the rampage killings so poignant is they're up close and personal. They're on the ground. They're mano a mano. They're, you know, on the ground, human to human. And
right.
I can, to this day, I can vividly remember in the 70s in junior ROTC, my major talking, who had been a pilot himself, talking about how, you know, one of the advantages of being in the Air Force is, you know,
right.
you go out, you participate in action, and then you fly home
right.
and have clean sheets and a hot chicken dinner, you know,
right.
or the grunts
yeah.
are out in the field, you know, hand to person to person.
Yeah, but I want to tell you. I want to interrupt here. My father was a turret gunner in a B-17 Flying Fortress, and he flew his some 20 missions. Almost everyone he knew was killed while he was flying those missions. While he would say the same thing, that the carnage that they were causing below them was unknown to them. They carried it with them.
Oh, okay.
They carried it with them. They carried it with them for the rest of their lives. They knew that when they firebombed a city, that thousands of women and children were burning to death and were literally on fire, and that the agony was extraordinary. They knew that.
Well,
they just didn't see it.
Not shared. They were not sociopaths. So if they were smart, they're not. They had consciences. Then you know,
yes,
and, yeah,
correct.
They would experience
correct.
That.
Right. You know, it's why in World War II, the government realized that they needed to change the way that the military personnel were indoctrinated, because in World War II, given the option, when a soldier holding a gun had a soldier on the other side in his sights and actually had the opportunity to look at the other individual through the sights of his gun and to consider whether or not he wanted to take that individual's life, that 99 out of 100 would not do so.
Well, this is why they're training police now with paper targets to show pictures of pregnant
correct.
Women and the elderly.
Correct.
Because they have
correct.
To desensitize them, they have to sear their consciences, they have
correct.
To make them small-time sociopaths.
Correct. And that's basically what we did. We made them sociopaths. And that's why now, you know, you have some 80 returning Afghan and Iraqi vets taking their lives every day. And you have maybe 10 times that number reporting that they have a psychiatric trauma from their experience. Because what we did is we positioned – the Muslims that we were now laboring, naming as insurgents, which were just civilians, we had to make them monsters worthy of death. But the problem is you couldn't distinguish the monster from a non-monster. They all look the same. And so the kind of cognitive dissonance between the idea that you had been told that you were there to defend your country and you knew there was absolutely nothing that America had at stake here. And then you're told that you're there to liberate these people, and it's the people themselves that wanted you dead. How do you deal with that?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And there's a famous, one of the most famous Air Force aces, I think from the Vietnam era, was like an academy failure, you know, but then it became one of the greatest aces. And, you know, when the man's interviewed, he spoke about how, you know, his conscience was so, you know, rattled and shaken by, you know, he was an ace. And he was only dealing in air combat. He killed individual pilots who were trying to kill him, and even so, he was greatly disturbed by his experience, you know, by what he had done.
Yeah, you know, I think to a large degree, and when I say this, younger people have a conniption fit, but to a large degree, video games where first-person shooter games where, you know, you get to go off and slaughter, and then you get to reset and everything is just fine, that has done a lot to desensitize individuals. And then a lot of our movies...
I remember thinking that in the 80s. Yeah. I can remember thinking that express thing in the 80s. Are we being trained?
Right.
You know, especially when you started to get into Wolfenstein, Duke Nukem, you know, all the Quake games, and then just got worse from there, you know.
Right, and look at all the mass carnage in so many of our most popular movies. You know, it's just people get blown up and explosions and people shooting, and you know, it's we go almost like we're going to the Colosseum in Rome to be entertained by the carnage.
Oh, and even the hero. I mean, he's on the highway. There's all kinds of accidents and crashes and bullets flying everywhere in people's cars. And they're just like in the Matrix, you know. They're just like as if they don't matter, you know.
Right.
People just got killed in your chase scene, but that does, they don't matter, you know.
They don't matter. Yeah, it's we have fundamentally changed society, and the change has caused far too many people to be savages, and those who are not savages or sociopaths are afraid to stand up, either afraid to stand up or they're incapable of standing up, that they've lost their backbone, that they've lost their ability to be judgmental, that they don't recognize that what they're witnessing is wrong and that there's a consequence of not standing up against it.
I think anyone thinking of going to the military should watch, or especially the Air Force, any air arms, should be compelled to watch the movie The Bridges of Toko Rhee.
Yeah.
With William Holden and Mickey Rooney. Because you see, actually, in that movie, you actually see this lawyer who is a reserve officer, you know, sort of pensively wrestling with these issues.
Right.
And, you know, he, spoiler alert, I mean, he's eventually killed when his plane shut down and the arrest doors are shut down. And then, you know, some of this, when there's conscience and actual personal loss and personal deliberation and angst about it. You almost never see that in these modern movies. They're just glory and sex and women.
But in our modern military, the reason that so many hundreds of thousands of returning vets are so traumatized by what happens is that once we gear them up to perpetrate this kind of carnage, we can't take it out of them.
And so
they're forever ruined. I mean, I looked at my father. My father and I did not have a good relationship. But my father never recovered from the war. He would never talk about it. He never got it out of him. It haunted him the rest of his life. And he volunteered for it, you know, so did so many to go and fight for this noble cause. And yet the cause wasn't noble. And the means that we used to deploy it, we didn't value the lives of our own troops, much less the lives of anyone else. You know, I watched a movie the other day, not a movie, it was a documentary on our our strategy as it related to Europe, and how in World War II we began by dropping leaflets in cities like Dresden and telling them that we were going to firebomb those cities and we were going to inflict such pain on the civilian population that it would make it more difficult for the Germans to continue to promote the war effort. We deliberately went after unarmed civilians and we roasted them alive.
Well, this is kind of known as total war. I mean, as we're always, you know, the Civil War per capita was the biggest bloodbath possibly in history per capita.
Yes.
In World War I, you had the trench warfare and mustard gas and all that.
Right.
But basically, you still had troops fighting troops.
Right.
In World War II, we saw the full transition to total war in which civilians became fair game.
That's right. Yeah. Something dramatically happened to our conscience. And we even had nations like China and Russia killing their own by the tens of millions. Yeah, something dramatic happened. And it was evil. We'll be back after the break. Amazing story out of Cairo. The Lone Challenger. Remember I shared this with our listeners, Glenn, here about 2-3 weeks ago, that there was only one person running in opposition to Sisi in the Egyptian elections, and he was a communist. Well, the Lone Challenger in Egypt's presidential elections withdrew all of his monitors from the polls Wednesday, complaining that many of his monitors, his just campaign workers, were being assaulted by the police. That as the government, police, and military tried to stuff ballots, doing it in an absolute waste of time, because Sisi controls all of the media. Sisi's has decided who could run against him. Sisi has police have prevented public assembly. So there is no way that any candidate can promote themselves. They can't use the media. They can't even use public assembly. They can't use the mail. They can't do anything. And even if they have campaign workers who are trying to monitor the polls, the police are arresting and harassing them.
Well, yes, and, yeah, but at least it's democracy in action, which means it's inherently an improvement.
So you have a military coup, and the head general of the military coup outlaws the party that received 70% of the votes in the last election, imprisoning them, giving them death sentences, closing down all their offices, stealing all of their funds, and telling anyone who's associated with them that they will arrest them as well. And so you eliminate 70% of the people from the election, and then you control the media entirely, and you control the police, you control the entire situation where you choose who gets to run against you, and you pick a communist.
Right.
And even the communist says, man, I can't handle this anymore. They are way too vicious. Yeah, that's democracy in action, all right, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. All
hail Sisi.
It's just absolutely ridiculous, obviously. And the thing is, I guess the people know this, you know. But which election was it? I saw a story on the other night about where people aren't even showing up at the polls.
Well, that's the Egyptian election.
Why bother?
They kept the polls open another day because they can't get anybody to vote. The overwhelming preponderance of Egyptians aren't even voting. And yet, with this tiny percentage voting, they're still stuffing the ballot box. I mean, they're still so corrupt that they're stuffing the ballot boxes and the overwhelming. And when they report on some community that's voted and the percentage that showed up, it's not because people showed up to vote. It's because they created the votes. They just stamped them out.
It's really what's best for the people. They're just too stupid to know that. And the ends justify the means, you see.
You know, and of course, the United States is solely responsible for the Egyptian military. We pay 100% of its costs. Just, and we educated both of these guys. Morsi received his education at the University of Southern California, and Cece was educated in war colleges by the U.S. military. We educated both of them. They're both our boys.
Well, then they have to be good. That's how you know the ancestors by the means.
Oh, that's great, yeah.
But actually, you mentioned the idea of our responsibility. I wanted to harken back for a minute to what you were talking about early in the program about culpability. Mm-hmm. You were saying about how, people are as much to blame as the perpetrators.
Yes. Yeah.
And stuff.
Uh-huh.
And what's, there's actually a little bit of a, I want to put a little spin on that.
Please.
Because here in American jurisprudence, we recognize the concepts of aiding and abetting or being an accessory. In which case, you're culpable, but you're considered to be culpable, but not necessarily equally culpable.
If you drive the getaway car for a blank bank robber and somebody in the bank was killed, you can be convicted of murder.
Right.
You're an accessory. You're an accessory to murder. And what is different in driving the getaway car and doing what the Muslim guy did or what the president of the United States did in exonerating this religion?
Well, what I wanted, and that's true. And what I wanted to get to this, you also talked about us providing the weapons.
Right.
And in a sense, we are the ones who commission these crimes.
Yes.
By providing the weapons, which I think makes us more culpable because we're actually the cowards who throw money at the situation, commission wicked people to do these things and hide in the shadows, which to me, when you're the one who instigated it and commissioned it and paid for it, who's more culpable, the hitman or the mafia don?